Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on a clash of civilizations right after this. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant negotiated by Moses out of Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush said that what Americans wanted, though, was jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. There's no money in public business, and there's no money in jobs, jobs, jobs. Now it's time that you cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of the Old Covenant contract and to collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's called real property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn more about how to do just that, why don't you call for information on my compact disc homeschool for adults and order my free general law CD package at the same time. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free. All you have to do is call and order. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. Click on to the email machine and send an email request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. You know, only a few years ago, mass murder attacks on the West in the name of Islam, like those of September 11th, would have seemed like a thriller writer's fantasy. Nor would anyone have imagined that a bombing by Islamists would swing a general election in a major European country, or that a Dutch movie maker might be shot dead on the street for a film about the abuse of women in Islam, or that one might find yourself or oneself watching on television the beheading of Western hostages by men crying out Allahu Akbar over their savage deeds. Pakistan now has a nuclear bomb, and this weapon is widely described as an Islamic bomb. To judge by their pronouncements, the Islamist leaders of Iran can hardly wait to perfect and then use their derivative of it. And at present, it is not clear whether the religious ideological rage that is the motive force behind these developments has any limits, whether it may yet succeed in mobilizing truly huge numbers of Muslim masses, or whether it can be deflected or crushed. What is clear is that a phenomenon that at first looked like a cloud no bigger than a man's hand was lashed up into a crisis with global implications. Now, does this crisis amount to a clash of civilizations? Many people reject that notion as being too sweeping or downright misleading. And yet, whether or not it applies to, say, the situation in Iraq or to the war on terror, the phrase has much to recommend as a description of what is going on inside of Europe today. As Ives Charles Zerka, a French philosopher and analyst, has written, he said, there is taking place in France a central phase of the more general and mutually conflicting encounter between the West and Islam, which only someone completely blind or of radical bad faith or possibly a disconcerting naivete could fail to recognize. In the opinion of Bassam Tibi, an academic of Syrian origin who lives in Germany, Europeans are facing a stark alternative. Either Islam gets Europeanized, or Europe gets Islamized. Going still farther, the eminent historian Bernard Lewis has speculated that the clash may well be over by the end of the century, at which time, if present demographic trends continue, Europe itself will be more than 50% Muslim. Today's situation has been a very, very long time, centuries, in fact, in the making. For much of that time, of course, the encounter between Muslims and the West remained stacked in favor of the West, both militarily and culturally. Which is not to say that Europeans of an earlier age were blind to the danger posed to Western civilization by a resurgent Islam. One watchful observer was Winston Churchill. Churchill wrote about Islam, or Mohammedism, as it was then called, in The River War in 1899. No stronger retrograde force exists in the world today. Far from being moribund, Mohammedanism is a militant and proselytizing faith. It has already spread throughout Central Africa, raising fearless warriors at every step, and were it not that Christianity is sheltered in the strong arms of science, the civilization of modern Europe might fall, as fell the civilization of ancient Rome. Hilaar Belloc had similar premonitions 30 years later in The Great Heresies, written in 1938. Will not perhaps the temporal power of Islam return, and with it the menace of an armed Mohammedan world which will shake the dominion of Europeans, still nominally Christian, and reappear again as the prime enemy of our civilization? Since we have here a very great religion, physically paralyzed but morally intensely alive, we're in the presence of an unstable equilibrium. To these early observers, nevertheless, it did seem that Western cultural and military superiority could be counted on to prevail, at least for the foreseeable future. Belloc is better remembered for his boast that we have got the Gatling gun and they have not. And prevail it did throughout a good part of the 20th century. In the last decades, though, of the 20th century, another historical process has been at work, drastically revising the calculus of the power balance in the world. Contemporary Islamism might be summed up as the effort to redress and then reverse the long-ago defeat of Muslim power by Europeans, that is, the Christian civilization, during the Middle Ages. Toward that end, it has followed two separate courses of action, adopting the forms of nationalism that have appeared to many Muslims to contain the secret of Western supremacy, or promoting Islam itself as the one force capable of uniting Muslims everywhere and hence ensuring their renewed power and dominance. In the hands of today's Islamists and with the complicity of Europe itself, these two approaches have proved mutually reinforcing. In Europe, the world wars of the last century finally undid and discredited the idea of the sovereign nation state, the engine of the continent's preeminence and self-confidence. In place of the nation state, of this tried and tested political arrangement, now suddenly seen as outmoded and dysfunctional, institutions like the European Union and the United Nations were thought to offer a firmer foundation for a new world order, one that would be based on universal legal norms and in which sovereign power would be rendered superfluous. It has been the resulting decline of the European nation-state that has helped provide a unique opportunity for Islam, itself based on a worldwide transnational community that has been united by faith and custom since its inception, and that traditionally has drawn no distinction between the realm of faith and the realm of temporal power. A number of ideological movements have spread and fortified the modern projection of transnational Islam. Perhaps the most successful has been the Muslim Brotherhood, founded by Hassan al-Banna in Egypt in 1928, with branches today in more than 50 countries around the world. Yasser Arafat and Ayman al-Zawahiri, Osama bin Laden's deputy, are among those formed by the Brotherhood. Its more recent, the Egyptian-born Saeed Qutb, on the other hand, to the sub-replacement birth rate that has become the norm among other Europeans. The demographic facts alone suggest that a continent ripe for a determined effort to advance the Islamic agenda is at hand. In its global reach and its aggressive intentions, Islamist ideology bears some resemblance to other transnational belief systems, namely communism. Like today's Islamists, communists of an earlier age saw themselves as engaged in an apocalyptic struggle in which every member of a communist party anywhere in the world was expected to comport himself as a frontline soldier, and in which terror was seen as a wholly permissible means toward victory in a war to the finish. Just compare Joseph Stalin's, "If the enemy does not surrender today and conquer here." Throughout the Cold War era, the European democracies, under threat from Soviet expansionism, were themselves home to communist parties, as well as to an array of front organizations ostensibly devoted to peace and friendship and culture. But in reality, manipulated by and for Soviet purposes, they sought the destruction of their host nations. In addition, many people from all walks of life accommodated themselves to communism with varying degrees of emotional intensity and out of various motives. They included the wish to be on what they perceived as the winning side, and the converse fear of winding up on the losing side. Each of these elements in suitably transmuted form is present today. The pool of local recruits upon which Islamists draw is itself very large. Of Europe's 20 million Muslims, it is estimated that 5 or 6 million live in France alone, at least 3 million in Germany, 2 million in Britain, 1 million apiece in Holland and Italy, and a half million apiece in Spain and Austria. It is true that most Muslim immigrants to Europe come simply with hopes for a better life, and that these hopes are more important to them than any apprehensions that they might entertain about living in a society ruled by non-Muslims, something that historically prohibited in Islam. Indeed, large numbers have assimilated with greater or lesser strain, and in the manner of other minorities have become hyphenated as British Muslim or French Muslim, Italian Muslim, and the like. Religious life flourishes in the West. If a half century ago there were but a handful of mosques throughout Europe, today every leading country has over 1,000. And France and Germany each have somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 Muslim mosques in those countries. Muslim pressure groups, lobbies, and charities operate effectively everywhere. In Britain alone, there are 350 Muslim bodies of one kind or another. Among these various organizations, however, a number function as Islamist fronts, inspired by Saudi Arabia or Khomeiniist Iran, by the Muslim Brotherhood or Al-Qaeda. They work to undermine democracy in whatever ways they can, just as Soviet front organizations did in communist parties throughout the world. They push immigrants to repudiate both the process and the very idea of integration, challenging them as a matter of religious belief and identity to take up an oppositional stance to the societies in which they live. Issues of Islamic concern have been skillfully magnified into scandals in the attempt to foment animosity on all sides and thus further deter or prevent the integration of Muslims into mainstream European life. The notorious 1989 fatwa condemning the novelist Salman Rushdie to death for exercising his right to free speech as a British citizen was an early example of this tactic of disruption and agitation. A page torn right out of the Communist Manifesto. Another has been the attempt in Britain to set up a Muslim parliament that will recognize only Islamic law as being binding, and that the law of the land shall be Muslim law, not British. Still another has been the instance in France on the wearing of the hijab by girls in public schools, a practice that clearly contradicts the ideals of French republicanism and is in any case not an Islamic requirement. The tactical thinking behind such incitements was well articulated by an Al-Qaeda leader who, calling upon British Muslims to bring the West to its knees, added that they, the locals, and not foreigners, have the advantage since they understand the language, the culture, the area, and the common practices of the enemy whom they coexist among. Muslims are taught to regard the natives of the lands in which they have become adopted subjects to be their enemies. Still another phenomenon familiar from the Soviet era has lately made a repeat appearance in the West, and that is voluntary accommodation or fellow traveling among non-Muslims. Leftist fellow travelers once helped to create a climate of opinion favorable to communists and communism. Many knew exactly what they were doing. Others merely meant well. They were what Lenin called useful idiots. In like manner, Islamist fellow travelers and useful idiots are today weaving a climate of opinion that advances the purposes of radical Islam and is deeply damaging to the prospects of reconciliation. As in the 1930s and throughout the Cold War, intellectuals and journalists are in the lead. Books pour from the presses to justify everything and anything Muslims have done in the past and are doing in the present. Just as every Soviet aggression was once defined as an act of self-defense against the warmongering West, today terrorists of Al-Qaeda or of the Chechen terrorists who killed children in the town of Beslan are described in the media as militants, activists, separatists, armed groups, guerrillas, in short, anything but terrorists. Dozens of apologists, especially in the media and the press, pretend that there is no connection between the religion of Islam and those who practice terror in the name of Islam, or suggest that Western leaders are no better or are indeed worse than Islamist murderers. Thus, Karen Armstrong, the well-known historian of religion, said, "It's very difficult sometimes to distinguish between Mr. Bush and Mr. Bin Laden." One form of Islamist fellow traveling masquerades as a call for tolerance or diversity and has penetrated right through the world of European opinion and European institutions. The British communist historian Christopher Hill once concluded a book on Lenin with a reverent recital of the epithets the party had devised to glorify him. Pious Muslims follow the mention of the Prophet Muhammad with invocation, "Peace be upon him." This practice has now crept into the biography of the Prophet written by a British writer, not ostensibly a Muslim. To encourage such acts of deference, there has been a complementary effort to stifle contrary or less than fully respectful opinions. When the outspoken French novelist Michel Houellebecq pronounced Islam to be hateful, stupid, and dangerous, Muslim organizations and the League for the Rights of Man took him to court, just as the Italian writer Oriana Fallaci was sued for her book tying the 9/11 attacks to the teachings of Islam. Although both writers won their cases, the chilling effect on writers worldwide has been unmistakable. The institutions that have been affected by Islamophile correctness has run the gamut. In Britain, a judge has agreed to prohibit Hindus and Jews from sitting on a jury in the trial of a Muslim. The British Commission for Racial Equality has ordained that businesses must provide prayer rooms for Muslims and pay them for their absences on religious holidays. In a town in the Midlands, a proposal to renovate a 100-year-old statue of a pig was rejected for fear of giving offense to the Muslims. The British Council and International Organization for Cultural Relations fired a staff member who published articles in the Sunday Telegraph arguing that the roots of terror and jihad were nourished in the soil of Islam, while the BBC canceled the contract of a popular television journalist for allegedly using negative language to describe the Muslim-Arab contribution to mankind. Commercial society has likewise rushed to accommodate real or imagined Muslim sensibilities. A British bank boasts that it will comply with Sherry's prohibitions on the uses of money, and the German state of Saxony, Anhalt, has become the first European body to issue sukuk, or Islamic bonds. Religious society is not far behind. Even as Osama bin Laden speaks of wresting Spain from the infidels by violence, the Cathedral of Santiago has considered removing a statue of St. James Matamoros, the Moor slayer, lest it give offense to the Muslims. For the same reason, the municipality of Seville has removed King Ferdinand III, hitherto the city's patron saint, from fiesta celebrations because he fought the Moors for 27 years. In Italy, where Islamists have threatened to destroy the Cathedral of Bologna because of the fresco illustrating the Prophet Muhammad in the Inferno where Dante placed him, thought has been given to deleting the artwork from the walls. Even the Pope has apologized for the Crusades. In secular Denmark, the Quran, but not the Bible, is now required reading for high school students, and so forth. The lengths to which apologists for Islamism are prepared to go is nicely illustrated by the case of Tariq Ramadan, a professor of Islamic studies at the University of Freiburg in Switzerland and a popular writer and speaker. As is well known, the American University, Notre Dame, recently offered Ramadan a professorship, but U.S. immigration authorities have so far rejected his application for a visa. This was elicited and has elicited some classic examples of fellow traveling obfuscation from both Americans and Europeans outraged on his behalf. A letter to the Washington Post protesting Ramadan's treatment undertook to explicate his supposed message to Western Muslims. They must find common values and build with fellow citizens a society based on diversity and on equality. You are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the webpage, georgegordon.org. Click on to the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. Tonight's report, A Clash of Civilizations. Well, what Tariq Ramadan was and has really proposed in his writing and teaching is that Muslims in the West should conduct themselves not as hyphenated citizens seeking to live by common values, but as though they were already in a Muslim-majority society and exempt on that account from having to make concessions to the faith of others. What Ramadan advocates is a kind of reverse imperialism. In his conception, Muslims in non-Muslim countries should feel themselves entitled to live on their own terms, while under the terms of Western liberal tolerance, society as a whole should feel obligated to respect that choice. Ramadan happens to be a grandson of Hassan al-Banna, founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, but he's also a guarded writer. In fact, his is a relatively moderate and qualified expression of Islamic reverse imperialism. More overtly, and with an implicit threat of violence, a Lebanese, Dayab Abu Jajid, who has settled in Antwerp, has denounced the Western ideal of assimilation as cultural rape and aims to bring all the Muslims of Europe into a single independent community. He, too, needless to say, has his defenders and apologists among European liberals. Or consider the European reception of Youssef al-Qaradawi, heir to Sayyid Qutb, as the religious authority of the Muslim Brotherhood. He's wanted on charges of terrorism in his native Egypt. Al-Qaradawi now lives in Qatar, and like Tariq Ramadan in Switzerland, he emphasizes that Muslims must keep apart from liberal democracy as it is practiced in the West, while also availing themselves of its benefits and advantages. But he goes much further than that. Unlike Ramadan, he approves of wife beating in the form sanctioned by the Quran. As for homosexuals, he is agnostic on whether they should be thrown off a high cliff or simply flogged to death. Yet this year, in an official ceremony at London City Hall, al-Qaradawi was welcomed as an Islamic scholar held in great respect by the mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. "You are truly, truly welcome," gushed Livingstone, an otherwise enthusiastic supporter of gay pride. Also appearing this year in London was Sheikh Abdul Rahman al-Sadusis, a senior imam of the Grand Mosque of Mecca. Among his many distinctions, Al-Sadusis was vituperated, or has vituperated, Jews as the scum of the human race, the rats of the world, the violators of pacts and agreements, the murderers of the prophets, and the offspring of apes and pigs. Standing beside this apostle of diversity and equality was a junior minister in the Blair government. The Islamic Foundation, one of Britain's numerous Muslim bodies, has an offshoot called the Mark Field Institute. In July, the London Times linked both the foundation and the institute to terrorism. An offended reader with an English name wrote to protest, "I hope that Markfield will be allowed to help individual Muslims to practice their faith with peace and respect in a multicultural Britain." Another reader, an Anglican canon in the Diocese of Leicester, a city with a Muslim majority today, asserted that the institute was simply trying to teach imams and Muslim youngsters alike to work within British institutions. In just that spirit, and even in that vocabulary, a fellow traveling Beatrice Webb used to advance the transcendent virtues of the Soviet social model, gullible, false, and dangerous statements of this kind are now as common as rain in Britain. In the realm of classical Islam, Christians and Jews once lived as demesis, that is to say, minorities with second-class rights, tolerated but discriminated against by law and custom. Many contemporary Muslims appear to idolize this long-lost supremacy over others and aspire to reconstruct it. One way to work for this end is through violence and terror. Another way, the way of Tariq Ramadan and Yusuf al-Qaradawi, is through words. One way and another, the project is advancing. Summing up the collective achievements so far, Bat Yor, the historian of Demititude, has written that Europe has evolved from a Judeo-Christian civilization with important post-Enlightenment secular elements to a secular Muslim transitional society with its traditional Judeo-Christian mores rapidly disappearing. And she calls this evolving entity Eurabia. Now, if that's the case, or is becoming the case, is it any wonder then that some Europeans are switching sides so as to be on the winning side? The sheer elan and cultural confidence displayed by Islamist spokesmen may have something to do with the fact that every year thousands of people all over Europe convert to Islam. Some of these converts from Britain, France, and Germany, taking the direct route from words to action, have gone on to play a disproportionate role in terrorism and Islamist militancy. Thus, at a rally organized in London last year by a radical offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, a very high proportion of demonstrators were clearly not of Middle Eastern origin. At a recent trial in Cairo in which three British citizens were condemned to prison for subversion and intended terrorism, two were English-born and with even English names. They were led away shouting defiance of the West. There are certainly Muslims in Europe who look with horror upon what is being done in their name and who wish to have nothing to do with the notion that they're entitled to live in the West as, in effect, conquerors. For wholly understandable reasons, few of them have the courage to speak out. One of the exceptional few recently wrote a letter to the London Times, giving his name and address and saying that he defines his community as the people with whom he chooses to interact, and he went on, "We do not all subscribe to the same way of being a Muslim, and neither do we push our beliefs into the civic and political sphere. But," he continued, "sadly, the public does not always get our point of view, because the only Muslims who are consulted are those who choose to drag Islam into the political sphere of everyday life. One could not ask for a clearer repudiation, not only of all Muslim Brotherhood-style proselytizers, but even more bitingly of the patronizing and indulgent attitude adopted toward them by the European establishment. Those in Europe who have striven in ways great and small to extend special privileges to Muslims while subtly deprecating their own national identity and their own national culture, have indeed helped open the way to Islamic separatism and Islamist agitation. They have thereby hastened the very clash and cultural confidence displayed by Islamist spokesmen may have something to do with the fact that every year thousands of people all over Europe convert to Islam. Some of these converts from Britain, France, and Germany, taking the direct route from words to action, have gone on to play a disproportionate role in terrorism and Islamist militancy. Thus, at a rally organized in London last year by a radical offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, a very high proportion of demonstrators were clearly not of Middle Eastern origin. At a recent trial in Cairo in which three British citizens were condemned to prison for subversion and intended terrorism, two were English-born and with even English names. They were led away shouting defiance of the West. There are certainly Muslims in Europe who look with horror upon what is being done in their name, and who wish to have nothing to do with the notion that they're entitled to live in the West as, in effect, conquerors. For wholly understandable reasons, few of them have the courage to speak out. One of the exceptional few recently wrote a letter to the London Times, giving his name and address and saying that he defines his community as the people with whom he chooses to interact. And he went on, "We do not all subscribe to the same way of being a Muslim, and neither do we push our beliefs into the civic and political sphere. But," he continued, "sadly, the public does not always get our point of view, because the only Muslims who are consulted are those who choose to drag Islam into the political sphere of everyday life." One could not ask for a clearer repudiation, not only of all Muslim Brotherhood-style proselytizers, but even more bitingly of the patronizing and indulgent attitude adopted toward them by the European establishment. Those in Europe who have striven in ways great and small to extend special privileges to Muslims while subtly deprecating their own national identity and their own national culture, have indeed helped open the way to Islamic separatism and Islamist agitation. They have thereby hastened the very clash of civilizations that they or some of them foolishly claim that they're trying to avoid. If Bassam Tibi is correct in stating that either Islam gets Europeanized or Europe gets Islamized, powerful forces are at work to foreclose that very question. I commented on this last night as I was talking about the Muslims. And I got another short article in here that I want to share with you that deals with the Nobel Prize. Now listen to this. If you got a pen and paper there handy, note this down. The following are the facts and verified statistics on the Nobel Prizes. The global Islamic population is approximately 1,200,000,000 people, or approximately 20% of the world's total population. And they have received the following Nobel Prizes. There's a total of seven. In 1988, Najib Mahfouz won the Nobel Prize for Literature. In 1978, Mohammed Anwar El Sadat won the Nobel Peace Prize. In 1994, Yasser Arafat won the Nobel Peace Prize. In physics, in 1990, Elias James Corey won the Nobel Physics Prize. And in 1999, Ahmed Zewail won the Physics Prize. That's two in the 1990s. In medicine, in 1960, Peter Brian Medawar won the Nobel Prize for Medicine. And in 1998, Fareed Murad won the Nobel Prize for Medicine. Now, that's a total of seven Nobel Prizes. Now, the Nobel Prize in Physics, Medicine, Literature, and Peace has been given out since about 1900, roughly. I think it was 1905 or 6 or 7 along in there, but it's been about 100 years. So for 100 years, they've been handing out these prizes. Now, the Muslims are a very significant part of Earth's population. And for them to win seven of these prizes over the past 100 years is very significant indeed. However, the global Jewish population is approximately 14 million people, or about 0.2% of the world population. And they have received the following Nobel Prizes. Now, if you get your pen and paper out there, write down 1,200,000,000. Now, that's nine digits long. That's 1,200,000,000. And then write down 14 million so that you can get a little perspective there. 1,200,000,000 Muslims and 14 million Jews. Over the past 100 years, the Nobel committees have given out seven prizes to these 1,200,000,000 Muslims in 100 years. A very significant contribution to the world's medicine, literature, physics, and peace prizes. However, these 14 million Jews, about 0.2% of the world population, have won 127 of those Nobel Prizes. 127. So write the number 7 down, and then under it write down 127, so that you can see the significance of the difference in these two cultures, these two civilizations, these two ethnic groups. 1 billion Muslims, 7 prizes. 20% of the world's population, 7 prizes. 14 million Jews, 0.2% of the world's population. Not even 1% of the world's population wins 127. In literature, Jews have won 10 prizes between 1910 and 1991. 10 in literature. In the peace field, the Peace Prize, they've won 8 between 1911 and 1994. In physics, between 1905 and 2000, they've won 22. In economics, between 1970 and 1993, they won 13. In medicine, between 1908 and 1995, they won 43. In physics, between 1907 and 1995, they won 31 prizes. Now, that's a total of 127 prizes in 100 years. The Jews are not demonstrating with their dead on the streets. They're not yelling and chanting and asking for revenge. The Jews are not promoting brainwashing the children in military training camps, nor are they teaching them how to blow themselves up and cause the maximum number of deaths of women and children and other non-Muslims. The Jews do not hijack airplanes, nor do they kill athletes at the Olympics. The Jews do not traffic slaves, nor have leaders calling for jihad and death to all of the infidels. And the Jews do not have the economic strength of the petroleum, nor the possibilities to force the world's media to see their side of the question. So perhaps if the world's Muslims could invest more in normal education and less in blaming the Jews for all of their problems, we could all live in a better world. When asked the question, would you rather be sitting on an airplane next to a Jew or next to a Muslim? Remember last night's program. Well, let's see what else is coming across the desk here. Let's take a look here at home equities. You probably have a home, and more than likely over the past few years, you've probably refinanced it. If you have, you've taken out your equity in your home. And you've probably spent that equity on something. What did you spend it on? And where is the housing market headed today? Well, from Kitco, we get this one pager. There's no place like home for the holidays. Unless you take a look at the mind-numbing amounts of home equity, which took years to build, being pulled out almost instantaneously to speculate on stocks. According to a December 19th Wall Street Journal story, homeowners are pulling money out of their real property at greater rates than ever. From 2001 through the first half of 2002, 11% of total funds obtained from mortgage refinancing were used for stock market and other financial investments. That's up from less than 2% during the previously studied period. The average sum that people are pulling from their homes to use for investments in stocks was $24,000. That's up from relatively small amounts in the earlier period. The $24,000 plowed into investments topped the averages for nearly all of the other categories for which people used proceeds, including home improvement. The Journal article went on to deliver one of our favorite quotes of all time in a brochure distributed at Merrill's annual meeting last year. It states, "You may think of your mortgage as a way to buy a house. At Merrill Lynch, we see it as a way to build your wealth. So let's think about this for a minute, boys and girls. The way to get rich is to take on more debt." Do you believe that? Well, then take those proceeds from levering up and speculate on overpriced stocks. Does that really make a lot of sense? It appears that only a collapsing dollar and the subsequent much higher rates that it will spawn will kill the average American's appetite to live beyond his means. Like a moth to a flame, the United States consumer cannot stop himself from spending and will behave rationally only when market forces dictate to him that he must. The most severe consumer recession since the Great Depression will likely accompany a monumental collapse in housing and autos, not to mention a significant weakening throughout our economy. A perfect storm is brewing, and we find it laughable that many in the press talk positively about the weakening dollar, given the chain reaction that it is likely to set off. The idea that a country can stem its currency decline any time that it wants to when it has such massive imbalances like the United States has is truly ludicrous. Likewise, a weakening dollar and the current account deficit are not the self-healing miracles that most economists would have us believe. So far, we have really only seen a correction in non-Asian currencies. The largest imbalances are with our Asian trading partners, and they stem from our insatiable appetite for their low-cost goods. A 15, 30, or even 50% decline in the value of the United States dollar will not be enough to make us competitive with the labor costs that are often one-tenth of what we can offer domestically. Only by a dramatic pullback in the United States consumption of Asian goods, resulting from the U.S. consumer being forced to fix his debt-laden balance sheet in the midst of higher rates, will the consumption imbalances begin to correct themselves. Santa's gift for Christmas may come in the form of massive dollar devaluation. Our readers are aware of this, and many have been wise enough to keep their savings in something other than dollars. Now, home values have been built on rotten foundations. We've been gleaning facts brick by brick in order to write the story on the housing market and what it all means for Wall Street and the economy. The story is simple. While the Federal Reserve is slowly raising interest rates, it's our observation that the housing price bubble is already bursting of its own accord nationwide. Let me begin with the sale of a property located a short distance away from our modest casa in Palm Beach, Florida, where the big houses have names, Casa Apava, an estate with ocean and lakefront land totaling 18 acres, is under contract for $70 million by its current owner, Ronald Perlman. This same property sold for $14 million in 1987. If the sale goes through, it will be the largest residential real estate sale in United States history. In 2004, the property was assessed for $33.4 million and taxes were a modest $664,000 a year, or about $55,333 a month. Needless to say, the buyer is reported to be the chairman of NVR Incorporated, the nation's eighth largest home builder. Clearly, selling homes at inflated prices to average Americans who bought them using other people's money has paid off handsomely for this CEO. Now, the size of the housing bubble should not be underestimated. In middle America, housing prices are up 44% over the past 5 years, while in the momentum markets, such as Las Vegas and Southern California, annual price pops of 20 to 40% have commonly been recorded until just recently. Housing is big business. In 2004, about 8 million new and used homes will sell with a total transaction value of $2 trillion. Mortgage debt will rise about $800 billion to a total of $7.5 trillion by the end of 2004. The increase in mortgage debt represents the spending that the Bush administration has needed to keep a $12 trillion economy moving forward. The good news is that home ownership rose 2% to an all-time record of 67.2. The bad news is that what had to be done to get it there, while the labor force participation rate has dropped 2%. In other words, easy credit and record low interest rates have boosted home sales. In previous economic cycles, the boost to home sales came from rising incomes and more jobs, not more debt and lower interest rates. Easy mortgage credit has been fostered by new mortgage products. New types of mortgages have been introduced over the past couple of years that transfer interest rate risk from the financial institution, that's the mortgage owner, to the borrower. And while allowing the borrower to take out the largest possible mortgage, long gone are the days when a borrower borrowed what was considered a safe, prudent amount that he could eventually pay back. Today, the borrower takes every penny that the lenders will lend. In turn, the lenders have gone crazy because at the end of the day, the lender is not lending his money. The loans go to a GSE security or into a rated mortgage security, which in turn is bought by a bank or hedge fund that is invested just for a short term in the cash and carry trade. Today, the new mortgage lenders are offering various types of mortgages to keep mortgage volume and quick origination profits up. These mortgages include adjustable rate, interest only, 40-year and piggyback. A piggyback mortgage is a senior mortgage combined with a junior mortgage that can leave the borrower owing more than 110% of the cost of the house. Moreover, these lending tactics leave the borrower more than a bit stretched and short liquidity. So it's no surprise that new mortgages that allow the borrower to skip payments and add the interest to principal are becoming very popular. What will lenders who don't lend their own money think of next? If these new types of mortgages aren't good enough to stretch consumers' buying capacity, then a few years ago, special charities sprang up to give a home buyer his 5% down payment. Since a home builder was giving the charity their funds anyway, he could easily give back 5% of his 30% profit to that charity. Clearly, charity starts at home. On top of that, President Bush signed the American Dream Down Payment Act of 2003. This legislation authorized $200 million a year in down payment assistance to at least 40,000 low-income families, and his goal was to increase the number of minority homeowners by at least 5.5 million before the end of the decade. Well, under federal law, if you're a first-time home buyer and your income is 20% less than the local median income, your neighbor, the U.S. taxpayer, will give you the greater of the $10,000 or 6% of the cost of the home to buy it. This subprime borrowers have influenced home ownership rates very considerably. However, there are some sobering facts about subprime borrowers. They're twice as likely to pick an ARM mortgage. ARM mortgages are already 30% of new home loans, and as the Federal Reserve raises interest rates to normal levels, the monthly payment of that ARM will go up over 25%. Well, subprime borrowers frequently refinance. Borrowers who refinance for cash out are twice as likely to default as those who don't take cash out. Currently, 70-80% of subprime mortgages are debt consolidation loans, which add credit card and other debt onto the house mortgage. These subprime mortgages have a terrible record. At least 16% are delinquent right now or in foreclosure, and 4.6% are actually in foreclosure. The funny money down payment mortgages are worse, with defaults running close to 20%. The Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, which insures these loans, says national FHA mortgage defaults are 11%, while in cities like Baltimore, Maryland, and Queens, New York, the default rates for FHA loans are 21%. And 25%. Perhaps more lenders could do what FNMA does with loans heading to default. That is, rewrite half of them and call them good. Remember, a rolling loan gathers no loss. Well, would a rational down payment mean for housing prices? Well, today a buyer who can scrape up $20,000 for a 5% down payment can afford a home priced at $400,000. If you ask him for a 10% down payment, he can suddenly only afford a home costing $200,000. You know, rational down payments will force housing prices down. So whatever you do, please do not share this observation with existing homeowners. They might want to sell before I've had a chance to follow up with Ron Perlman's example. I need to sell my house while the market's at the top. All right, we're just about out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. We'll take it up here tomorrow night, same time, same station, with the Law Hour and Editorial Review. You've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on a compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. All right, that's it. Time's up. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.